History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And of course, we've discovered they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions. And then to invest a little time patiently listening as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Every week, I know some of you are hearing this program for the very first time, especially when we welcome a new radio affiliate. And we get to do that this weekend with Truth 104, the Tri-Cities Voice of Truth, reaching Bristol, Kingsport, and Johnson City, Tennessee, from that home base in Southwest Virginia. And that's not to be confused with the other Tri-Cities in Washington, where maybe you're listening right now on KONA. Wherever you're listening, you can find nearly 800 previous episodes online at hometownheroesradio.com. And the 100-year-old Marine we get to meet today lives in Oceano, California, a stone's throw from the Pacific Ocean, where our longtime affiliates KVEC in San Luis Obispo and KSMA in Santa Maria reach Hometown Heroes listeners every weekend. Most of the veterans we meet on this show get introduced to us by listeners like you. And when more than one of you suggests the very same veteran, it's a pretty good clue to me that I better pay attention. So before I forget, I want to thank a couple of listeners out there on California's Central Coast. Linda and Candy, they both let me know about 100-year-old Jesse Arney. So thank you, ladies. In fact, Candy and her husband Phil got to cheer on Mr. Arney this past February for his 100th birthday when a great local group there called Welcome Home Military Heroes provided a special birthday parade in front of the home that Jess and his wife of 75 years, Lola, have shared there in Oceano for over four decades. Hopefully we'll get to hear from Lola a bit before we're done, too, if Jess lets her get a word in edgewise. You can find photos and a short video of this spirited couple at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're going to hear about how this Purple Heart recipient survived three major battles in the Pacific with Company B of the 3rd Tank Battalion, 3rd Marine Division during World War II. But we always like to take you all the way back to the beginning.
I was born in Maud, Oklahoma, 1923, and I grew up 8 years there, and then we moved to Shafter, lived there for 50 years. Then we moved over here, and we lived there for 40 years.
So where are you heading to next?
Up. Heaven. I'm going to heaven. I'm going there when I die.
I heard you like to sing. Well, so obviously you're a child of the Dust Bowl, and so many came from Oklahoma to California during that period.
We came from Oklahoma out here in 1932, which is when everybody was leaving Oklahoma.
Do you remember anything about those early childhood years in Oklahoma before you left?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, but I can't tell them. I was a little bitty fella, but I was fast. And the bigger kids would go off into the woods and play dare or double dare. And me being little and sneaky, I'd follow them and watch them. You'd be surprised what they dared to do in there. Anyway, that's another story that can't be told.
Well, that part I understand. Do you remember having some big ideas when you were a youngster of, hey, when I grow up, here's who I'm going to be or this is what I'm going to do?
I didn't have no ideas. I knew I was going to be something, but I wasn't worried about what I was going to be.
And, you know, most of us alive today didn't live through the Great Depression. Do you remember what things were like? Can you give us some perspective on that?
Well, I was young. I think I was around 8 or something like that. And we didn't have nothing. We was poor as church mice. But my dad was a professional gambler after that. And after he started that, we had plenty. But, yeah.
I know a lot of farmers who tell me they're professional gamblers. Are you talking about that, or he really was a professional gambler?
It's the way he made his living, with cards. And he was a good gambler, I guess, because we didn't have nothing before he started that. And then we had stuff good after that.
And I've interviewed quite a few World War II veterans who grew up in Oklahoma and came west, and a lot of them have some stories that put a picture in our mind of what that looked like when they came out. And it sometimes it kind of sounds like the Beverly Hillbillies, but sometimes not. What was your experience when you were coming this way?
Well, I'll tell you what. There was my uncle had this old Chevy, and he made it into like a camper, you know. And it had on each side a 1x12 on each side of it, and you could lay up there. But we all, it was my mother and dad and me and my two older sisters. And then I had a younger brother and a younger sister that came out with us. After that, we got more. But anyway, there was all that in one little car. But didn't we have, we pulled a two-wheel trailer, and we had it loaded with two mattresses on top. Typical Okie stuff, you know. Two mattresses on top. And my dad, he was my really stepdad, but he was my dad. We never called him stepdad or nothing. He was just our father. He was a good one, one of the best. And anyway, so we had this two-wheel trailer,
yeah.
And it was loaded, and it was just kind of overloaded, actually, I guess. And my dad and one of my aunt's brothers rode on top of that trailer, and then the car was full of people, and five of them, I think, was kids.
So they rode all the way from Oklahoma to California on top of the mattress on top of the trailer?
Yeah. Yes, they did. But we were poor people. But we had two mattresses.
What were they holding on to?
Well, the mattresses tied down. You know, there was ropes. Oh, we had a ball, I guess. I was only eight.
What was it like once you got to Shafter, California? What was life like there?
You see, we was different than most people. That they called them Okies. Most Okies, because we had a kinfolks that already lived out here. My grandmother and my grandfather and my uncle and aunt. And then the one that we come out here with, they already lived out here, and they come back to Oklahoma, and we come back to California with them. And that was in 1932. Anyway, we come out here, and we someplace in Arizona had a breakdown. Something about the axle slipped out of the trailer. So we had to send to my grandfather and mother's grandmother to get some money to fix the trailer. I was only eight, and then I had two older sisters, and then I had a brother under me was five, and then I had a sister under him.
So you had to camp out on the side of the road till the money came to fix it, or what?
Oh, yeah, we're good campers.
I know a little bit about your story in the Marine Corps, and I'm just trying to think in my head, which one was more impressive that you survived, that trip from Oklahoma to California at age eight, or what you went through in the Pacific?
Oh, no comparison there.
So you get to California, and did you go to Shafter High School?
Yeah, when we first came out here, we went to what you call Maple School, which was a little bitty country school, and I was in the second grade. And then I went to second and third there, and then we moved to another place, and I went to a little old country school, and there was 30 kids most of the time. I had one class, and they taught woodwork, and they taught cooking. I learned how to saw boards and nail boards and all that sort of good stuff that I can still do.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I saw the beautiful red, white, and blue lighthouse out front when I walked in, and was going to ask if you're still working with wood all these years later.
Not now. I built four or five lighthouses, and maybe six, I don't know, something like that. Then I built wishing wells. I built windmills. I built this. Put an extension on the bar over there.
So there in Shafter, as you're in your high school years, did you have any idea that a war was coming?
No. I didn't worry about stuff like that. I was just being ornery.
So I'm doing the math. Pearl Harbor happened when you were 18. Were you already done with high school?
I quit. I got smarter than the teachers when I was in the 10th grade.
Uh-huh.
After the 10th grade, I quit because I told them, I said, I'm smarter than you guys, so I'm quitting. So I quit and fiddled around and got into lots of mischief, you know. We run out of tires. I had this old 34 Chevy, and we run out of tires. So we was running on two wheels, two tires, and two rims. And I said, this ain't going to work. So we stole a trailer, two-wheel trailer, hauled it out in the country. And we was going to take the wheels off, but we couldn't get the wheels off, so we just left it out there. Finally, the police chased us down. And by that time, though, I'd already went to the Marines. So they got my brother and our friend, and they made them go and get that trailer and take it back and apologize. But they said, we know your brother was in with you. Said, but we're gonna let him get by with it.
Well, speaking of the Marines, I know you joined after Pearl Harbor.
I'll tell you how I got in the Marines. This leads right up to it right now. Yeah, and so I says to my friend, I says, we can't do this. Said, we got to do something. What are we going to do? And we said, we could join the service. He said, what branch? I said, well, the Marines. They got the prettiest uniform, so they'll get the prettiest girls. And sure enough, I got the prettiest girl. And we went to boot camp. Then from boot camp, we went to Camp Elliott and stayed a while. And they put me into driving into the motor pool to drive a truck. So I got in the truck, and I went and stayed going all day in the truck. So when I got back, they didn't like that at all. So they took me out of the motor pool, and they put me into the light artillery. So they called for an inspection, which as I disobeyed orders. I didn't fall out for inspection. So they put me into the mess hall. I did my little deal in the mess hall. So then when I got out, they put me in heavy artillery. So they called inspection. I damn nothing. So I didn't fall out for inspection. So they put me back in the mess hall. I kind of like that duty. So anyway, after that, let's see. Then they put me in the infantry, and they put me to carrying sea bags. You know what a sea bag is. Okay, I carried them from way over yonder, me and two or three other guys, way over to another storage. I don't know why, but they were heavy. So I decided, well, I don't like this. I don't want the infantry. I says, I want to get someplace where it's going to take something bigger than a rifle to get me. Because I said, I don't want to be shot while I'm just standing around outside. I said, I want to get in something that'll protect me. So they asked if anybody had ever drove a Caterpillar. I said, yeah, me. And I had before I went in the Marines. So they said, okay, you're going in the tank company. I said, okay. So they were there, and they took us out on the firing range. So the guy that took us was our instructor. His name was Murphy, tall, slim guy from Tennessee or something like that, or Tennessee or Kentucky, one of those places like that. And he took us, and he said, we're going to shoot at this target, and it's going to be a moving target. So he started to pull in across there, and I missed it, shot behind it. And he said, take a little lead. So I took a little lead on it, and the next nine shots, I put them all in there. So he said, you're going to be a gunner. So then I was his gunner for a while, and then he got promoted or something. And finally I got to be the, in Bougainville we had light tanks, but we couldn't do anything because Bougainville is mostly swamps. And they had coconut log roads, and we'd slip off into the boonies, into the marsh. But anyway, then they got the medium tanks. We went through Bougainville, and then we went through Guam, and we took Guam, which Guam belonged to us before.
And I'd love to hear more about that, because obviously you've never been in combat before. How did you adjust to this new reality you were living in?
That didn't bother me. I just take it as it goes. I didn't like authority. I didn't like it for people giving me orders. But anyway.
Did you experience some close calls in those battles that stand out in your memory?
Well, we were on Guam, and so we started to cross this little dirt road, and we got the front end out on it, and bam, 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 three shots. But this guy wasn't very smart. He hit the track, and he shot the track into. But our driver just put it in reverse and backed up. And while he was backing up, I was blasting that tank. He was camouflaged, but and my tank commander later, he said, boy, he said, you blowed the tar out of that tank. And anyway, we got called a retriever up, and they put us on fixed our track for us, and we went on about our business. And okay, well, so we took Guam. And then we made that our home base. And then from Guam, we went to Iwo Jima.
And before I hear about Iwo Jima, maybe you can give me a sense for how these tanks would operate, how many people you had in that crew, and what your role was.
Well, you know, the first, on Bougainville, we had light tanks. They had a 37 millimeter cannon and a machine gun. Okay, that was on Bougainville, and I was a gunner. And then we went from Bougainville, after we got Bougainville, went to Guam. But we got medium tanks before we went to Guam. So we went and took over Guam, and I was a gunner and a tank, and we had medium tanks, Shermans. So we kept those, and then we left from Guam. We went to Iwo Jima.
And when you say you're a gunner, can you give us a picture of where that means you would be in the tank?
That means that I was up on the turret where the tanks goes around, you know, the gun goes around, and I was operating that. And I had a machine gun, and I had a cannon. And then we had a loader, and then we had a tank commander. And then this was on the Shermans. And then we had a driver, and we had a assistant driver. And the assistant driver had a machine gun. So anyway, we from Guam, we stayed Guam. That was our home base. And so we was loading up ammunition. We was going to have another campaign. We didn't know where. We was loading up ammunition, and the general come around and was talking to us. And he said something about ammunition. I said, yeah, but they won't let us fill up. I said, they're only giving us just a partial load. I said, we need the full load. And so he said, you guys go ahead and fill that thing up. Says, I'll make it all right. So we took a full load of shells, and then we come. Then we went to Iwo Jima.
Iwo Jima, where American forces would suffer more than 27,000 casualties. More than 6,000 Marines lost their lives in a five-week battle for that small volcanic outpost. And Jesse Arney came awfully close to adding to that number. In fact, he was essentially left for dead inside his tank. We'll hear that chapter of his story from this 100-year-old World War II veteran when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.